Hello and welcome back to the IEA podcast. In this episode, the IEA's Director General, Mark Littlewood, speaks to IEA Economics Fellow Julian Jessop and IEA Fellow Professor Philip Booth about the state of the public finances. How relaxed or concerned should we be about the increase in public borrowing and debt as a result of the COVID crisis? If you enjoy this episode, please do subscribe and leave a review. You can also watch this podcast over on our YouTube channel. Thanks for listening.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's IEA Insights with me, Mark Littlewood, the Director General here at the Institute of Economic Affairs. The basis of today's discussion is around our new briefing paper authored by one of our guests today, IEA Economics Fellow and Independent Economist Julian Jessop. The paper's titled, How Deep a Hole Are We In? And he offers a dash of optimism, but also some causes for concern about the future of the British national debt, arguing that whilst it's misleading to suggest we have maxed out the credit card, it's worse to claim that the government has a blank check to borrow as much as it likes, whenever it likes. So he's arguing that we should see the COVID debt that we have accrued as a sort of one-off hit. We can be paid off over long-term debt rollovers, or at least maintained. Philip Booth, the IEA's Professor Philip Booth, the IEA's Senior Academic Fellow and Professor of Finance, Public Policy and Ethics at St Mary's, is also joining us today. He offers, I think, a slightly more concerned take of the view of the state of public finance, and has warned that as deficits add up, they definitely need to be taken seriously, and government debt needs to be small enough for the next generation to handle and look after. So welcome, Philip. Welcome, Julian. Good to have you both with us. Julian, let me start with you. How deep a hole are we in, indeed?
Well, as you said in your introduction, I'm relatively relaxed about where we are now. Obviously, I'd rather the pandemic hadn't come along, and rather that we hadn't had to borrow hundreds of billions of pounds to help deal with the economic fallout. But, you know, we are where we are. I think there are three reasons for being relatively relaxed about the near-term outlook. One is that the debt itself doesn't have to be repaid. It can simply be rolled over as long as the government can continue to meet the interest payment. So it's not as if we suddenly need to find another 300, 400 billion from tax increases or spending cuts anytime soon. The second point, obviously people are concerned about the prospect of interest rates going up, but it will be important to understand why interest rates would be going up. If it's because the economy is rebounding or inflation is picking up or some combination of the two, the boost from those factors to the public finances, I think, would more than offset any increase in the interest rate bill itself. So ironically, I think rising interest rates might well be a nice problem to have. And then the third point is the improving economic outlook. You know, the rollout of the COVID vaccine in particular, it's not going to turn the economy around on a sixpence overnight. But I think this period of economic weakness is likely to be measured in months now rather than years. Indeed, the Office for Budget Responsibility, alongside its more gloomy forecasts, also published an upside scenario that I think is actually increasingly likely, where economic activity returns to pre-COVID levels by the end of next year. Importantly, there's no long-term economic scarring, including a big increase in unemployment. And there's no hole in the public finances anyway in the longer term that needs to be filled. So those are the reasons for optimism over the short to medium term. But I'm quite happy to come back later with some of the reasons why I'm more concerned about what happens next.
Can I just, before I come to Philip, ask you about this sort of rollover point, which I get, and for viewers sort of seeking an analogy, it's a bit like having your credit card and you just pay the minimum payment or the interest payments each month. But I mean, that sure as hell doesn't come for free, right? I mean, you could hypothesize a state in which, you know, 80% of state spending is just on interest payments, and therefore you don't have much left for you know, education spending, health spending, or whatever it is that you want the state to spend money on. So, I mean, is that a sound economic way of looking at it, to sort of say, we'll never pay back this year's £400 billion deficit, we'll just meet the interest payments on it between now and eternity?
Well, I hope I was careful not to say that. Obviously, there are limits, but my point is we're a long way from reaching those limits. If you look at debt relative to national income or GDP, it looks like this year we're going to have a figure around about 105% of GDP. Now, actually, in the UK, we've had much higher numbers in the past, you know, particularly in the wake of the First and the Second World Wars. And also, even now, our debt to GDP ratio is quite a lot lower than many other major advanced economies, including the US, France, Italy, and Japan. So there is clearly a limit, but I don't think we're anywhere near it now. As to how much we're paying on an interest at the moment, ironically, the interest rate bill is actually lower than was anticipated a year ago. Obviously, the stock of debt has risen, but the interest rate we're paying on that debt has actually fallen. I can't remember the exact figure off the top of my head, but I think, you know, prior to the crisis, we were paying about 2% of GDP in debt interest payments. That figure over the next few years is unlikely to change very much at all.
Philip, let me come to you. It's a slightly artificial divide this in two ways. I suspect there's quite a lot of common ground between you and Julian first, and obviously there's a slightly artificial divide between the short term and the long term. But perhaps I can start with you, Philip, on the short term. Budget deficit this year of in the region of £400 billion on top of us not having run a budget surplus since the start of the millennium, I believe. How sanguine are you initially about, if you like, the one-off COVID hit, the government expenditure that's gone with that, and the presumably dwindling tax revenues that have gone arm in arm with that as well?
Okay, I mean, as far as the economics is concerned, I would agree with Julian there about the accumulation of the debt as a result of the COVID episode, if you like, and indeed as far as sort of wider moral issues are concerned as well, in that, you know, if you get these one-off events which hit from time to time, it's reasonable to amortize the cost of those across future generations. And you could argue the same about the financial crisis and the same about wars, of course. I suppose there are two things which concern me. One is that before COVID, and I was writing about this type of thing well before COVID, the long-term state of the public finances looked dire and not really comparable with the situations after the Napoleonic, the First and the Second World Wars. Secondly, we're having these one-off hits now rather regularly. So we had the financial crisis in 2010, and we've got the COVID crisis in 2020. And what happens if we have another one in 2030 and no productivity growth in between? And so the public finances don't, as they did between the First and Second World War and immediately after the Second World War, they don't improve before we get the next hit.
I think it was Warren Buffett's comment that, you know, when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked. And your worry is, Philip, that these hits are hitting us when we're, if you like, ever less healthy, as it were, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Less able to deal with it. Looking slightly at the longer term, then, Julian, I mean, an extra £400 billion on the debt this year, you know, deal with it somehow, or just pay the interest payments for the next 10 years and then worry about it. But what about the longer run public finances, of which this is, you know, an extra dollop of deficit on top, even if you think that dollop is dealable with? What's the longer term trajectory? Is Philip right that we've got a kind of underlying problem here that's been exacerbated?
Oh, I think he's definitely right. Two key points here. First of all, in terms of the longer term outlook, the Office for Budget Responsibility has published some long term scenarios going out over the next 50 years. And they suggest that if we don't do anything about how much we are spending on an aging population, so that's things like additional NHS costs and adult social care and state pensions and so on, then over that horizon, the debt GDP ratio, which is currently a little over 100% of GDP, could rise to something like 400% of GDP. Now that is a game changer. That is a really big difference compared to anything that we've seen recently. And the second thing that concerns me is that although I think the government was right to respond in the way that it did to the COVID crisis and, you know, borrow whatever it thought was necessary, this has, of course, set a precedent. And, you know, every previous crisis, what's happened is that, you know, all the spending has fallen back. It's never quite fallen back to pre-crisis levels, and the tax burden has ratcheted up. So there might be, as I described, this idea that, you know, because we were able to find all this money for the pandemic, we therefore got a blank check to spend money on almost anything else. And that creates all sorts of problems. I mean, even if you're not worried about the financial constraints, you might still be worried about the poor allocation of resources. We know that the government is terrible at spending other people's money. And the inflation risk as well, of course, because you know, to the extent this is financed indirectly by money printing and the government is spending loads of money and too much money is chasing too few goods and services, when the economy is back on its feet, then we might start to worry about inflation taking off. So yes, in the short term, I think it's daft to be talking about maxing out the credit card, partly because the argument is fundamentally wrong, but also because it distracts from, you know, other better reasons to be concerned about high public spending and high levels of state intervention.
Interesting. And Julian, is there, I'll come back to you, Philip, in just a moment. Is there a sort of cutoff point of the national debt? Again, I'm looking for a kind of key number and a tipping point, and I appreciate it will be more of a spectrum, but I think the orthodoxy has been sort of keep the national debt below 80% of GDP, which we were just about getting to. That we've blown that to pieces, obviously, with the COVID spending. As you say, it's now likely to be in excess of 100%. You were mentioning the long-term trajectory of 400%. Is there, do economists agree that there is some kind of key tipping point there or thereabouts, or is it just the worse the bigger it is incrementally?
Well, various people have had a go at trying to come up with a number. There was a famous paper by Reinhardt and Rogoff a few years ago that suggested that the tipping point was somewhere about 90 to 95% of GDP. But the problem there is that it a lot depends not just on the ratio of debt to GDP, but also what else is going on. And I don't think most people anticipated that we're going to go into this prolonged period of very low interest rates. So, you know, a debt to GDP ratio of 150% with very low interest rate, GDP ratio of 80% with relatively high interest rates. So there's an awful lot of other moving pieces in this jigsaw. What we can do, of course, is to look at other countries. And as I said earlier, our debt GDP ratio is a lot lower than many other major advanced economies. There's no sign that investors are losing confidence in the UK economy or institutions, at least not for this reason. So I'm sure there are limits, but I suspect they're an awful lot higher than we're at now.
Philip, is it right to think in terms of the limit, or is it just, if you like, an incremental problem? You know, a 1% national debt's worse than 0%, 2% worse still, 500% a lot worse still.
No, I think it's a mistake to think that there is a limit which applies to all countries generalized at all times. I mean, so all the examples that Julian has given, there are particular reasons which pertain in each case. I mean, firstly, I would say that Italy's level of debt actually is very, very damaging. It means that it has to have a huge primary surplus. In other words, tax receipts well above government spending to service its debt. And it has had such a primary surplus for some time. Japan has enormous levels of domestic saving. The US, of course, gets seniorage from the dollar. We have control of our own currency. So exactly where that point is, where investors might think, you know, the credit risk of the UK or the inflation risk, whichever it is, because essentially they both amount to the same thing, is too high, and therefore lose confidence. And then that in turn then causes interest rates to rise for reasons not connected with economic growth rising. Exactly where that point might be is very difficult to estimate. But because it's so difficult to estimate, that's one good reason for being really rather cautious as we build up debt, especially what's coming down the line over the next 50 years. And none of the factors which allowed us to reduce debt after the Napoleonic Wars, the First World War and the Second World War, are now in our favour. There's almost no chance of us generating a fiscal surplus because our government spending is just so high as a percentage of GDP, unlike in the 19th century. We could try the inflation trick again, but then we saw how damaging that was in the 1970s. And that led to problems throughout the 80s and 90s in terms of the cost of funding debt. The demographics add hugely to the issue, and they also add, of course, to the political pressures to increase spending, as the older people are a greater proportion of the population. So the Office for Budget Responsibility estimated that the debt in 50 years' time, which Julian mentioned was projected to be 400% of GDP on their middle scenario, would have only been 300% were it not for the May and Johnson governments making a whole load of spending commitments in relation to health and social care in just an 18-month period. So all that political pressure is in the wrong direction. And if investors look at all of this together and see it in the whole, we might have a really big problem well before the demographic crisis kicks in a big way.
Philip, we'll link to the article that you've written about this. I know you've written about it extensively in the, we'll link to it in the show notes, and of course to Julian's paper below the video on this screen. But tell us a little more about these sort of underlying conditions where you're sort of saying, well, you know, today we're not in anything like as good a position as coming out of World War, the First World War or the Second World War. I mean, that sounds unbelievably counterintuitive to most people, right? You know, London might be a bit quiet at the moment, but it hasn't been bombed. So what were the prevailing factors, you know, the three cards that were leaning in our direction when we've come out of other crises that you're worried we don't have in our top pocket now?
Well, actually, the bombing point is actually quite a good place to start, because, of course, the UK economy, as most economies were, was destroyed during the war and took a long time to recover. So that the debt immediately after the war was a very high amount and was a very high proportion of a GDP, which had real potential to grow because of the capacity of the economy being destroyed during wartime. Then in addition to that, you then had a huge baby boom, which for a few years led to increased costs in terms of education, but then led to a very rapidly expanding workforce and a large workforce relative to the number of older people. You had high real growth because of the recovery, and you had relatively low real interest rates because of what economists call financial suppression, that lots of restraints on markets preventing interest rates properly reflecting economic factors, which were very damaging to Britain compared with other countries. And then, of course, you had inflation, and which was hardly a good way to solve a debt crisis, which is why even South American countries don't tend to use the inflation route to solving debt crises these
anymore.
Days.
Yeah.
On the other note, that's now totally turned around in that if you look at the next 30, 40, 50 years, the older population is going to grow rapidly. We've created a welfare state, which means that most of the costs of providing for that older generation, including healthcare, quite a bit of long-term care and pensions costs, of course, are paid for by the taxpayers of the current generation. And because government spending is already so high, it's very difficult to see how we can raise taxes significantly to meet those increased government spending pressures. Okay. So the political dilemmas which politicians face will be most easily solved, just as they were most easily solved between 2018 and 2020, when May and Johnson took those decisions. They'll be most easily solved by putting off the day when we have to balance the books and accumulating more debt. Everything runs in the wrong direction, essentially.
Julian, do you share that analysis? And can you also tell our viewers, if you like, what are the metrics that we should be looking at? We've already discussed whether there is a sort of tipping point, whether it's 95%. But of course, the other feature as well is the demographic trends and the if you like, off-balance sheet liabilities, that if you're to meet those, you know, you can imagine that on the face of it, your public finances are in a healthy state, but sort of, you know, everybody's about to turn to a pensionable age and is promised gold-plated pensions and the rest of it. So there are these liabilities which don't show up in the immediate figures, but, you know, we're often hear about the ticking time bomb around pensions, but not exclusively pensions. What's the target or the number at the bottom of the spreadsheet that we should really be looking at?
Well, first of all, maybe unusually for two economists, I think I agree with pretty much everything that Philip has just said. He laid out the economic and political challenges extremely well. And it is that longer term demographic problem. It's a nice problem to have, of course, but it's still a problem for the public finances. And we really need to start having a proper grown-up discussion about that. And I think it's a discussion that doesn't start from the assumption that there is a path for public spending or a set of a certain welfare system that is a given and cannot change, and then thinking about raising taxes to pay for that. That's the usual way people seem to approach this. I would turn it around and look at the current level of public spending, which even before the pandemic was averaging around about 40% of GDP, and to ask whether that's not already enough to provide those public services and the sorts of things that we know the market would underprovide, and still leave room for the limited number of investment projects that, for one reason or another, the the private sector won't touch, but it's still worth doing. So I think we should have a sort of relentless focus on asking, does the state even need to be as big as it is now? I mean, sure, there are lots of activities that could be done at least as well by the private sector. And certainly when we talk about funding people's old age, whether that's through healthcare or pensions or whatever else it might be, I think it's fair to ask the question, is it necessarily right for the government to be doing this? Obviously, you know, putting this problem into the private sector doesn't make the problem go away. It might be that people have to, you know, save more into a private scheme rather than pay more in tax. So it still has an impact on income. But we know from other countries around the world, particularly in Europe, that those welfare systems and healthcare in particular that have a bigger degree of participation by the private sector, whether that's in funding it or providing the services themselves, they tend to provide better levels of healthcare and so on. So,
I mean, that's almost a widening of your efficient allocation point, right? Obviously, pensions need to be paid for, but the private sector providing that or more of that might be a better way of providing them than the state providing it, or social care perhaps as well.
That's exactly right. I mean, the problem doesn't go away just because you move it from the public sector to the private sector, but way will be that the private sector is more efficient at providing the services and the pensions and so on, or whatever else it is that people need in their older age. So that requires a bit of a mindset. And one of the problems I have with the pandemic is it has sort of created this idea that state intervention or government-driven recoveries are the only way of getting the economy back to normal or paying for anything in the future. And I think that clearly is wrong.
I've shared this frustration as well, that I keep hearing politicians of all stripes really saying, well, if you can find the money to spend on X, surely we can also find the money to spend on Y. And no, it's a bit more, it's a zero-sum game, right? If you spend all the money on, this came up on the extra defence spending. You can argue whether it's good or bad to spend more on defence, but the other was, well, if we're spending more on defence, surely we can also spend more on nurses' salaries. No, it's an either or. Philip, can I come back to you on remedies here? Both your prescription, but perhaps your prediction as well. I mean, you've mentioned, you know, perhaps we're at the taxable limits of the economy, near as damn it. We can't squeeze much more out in tax, perhaps. I'd be interested if you could develop that point. But, you know, how do we extract ourselves from this, even if we don't see it as an imminent crisis to dig ourselves out of this hole now? Over the next 20 years or so, how do we edge in a, you know, towards sustainability? And what do you think actually will happen? Is there a chance that those remedies that you advocate will have to be taken by force majeure? Or is it just as likely that we'll sort of limp on ever more slowly with slightly higher tax rates, slightly lower growth rates, et cetera?
Yeah, I think the better case scenario is that we will limp on, continually making the realistic scenario, not the best case scenario in all possible worlds, but the more likely realistic scenario is that we'll limp on, taking incremental actions which deal with the problem as we go along, and those incremental actions could include measures which increase participation in the labour force, deregulation to increase productivity, as Julian has suggested, reductions in government spending in various areas. And of course, in the so-called austerity era, when actually government spending didn't decrease very much at all, government spending did decrease a lot on welfare provision and other types of provision as well, student support, etc., for those of working age, whilst expanding for those of in older age groups. And then that really goes back to the political problem, that when you have these systems of state-provided pensions, healthcare, and so on in old age, you end up with a vicious circle, because as the population ages, it becomes harder and harder to reform those systems along the lines that Julian suggests. On the other hand, if you have privately funded pensions and the population starts to age, and so annuities get more expensive and so on, then people have an incentive to stay in the workforce longer. So you get a virtuous circle, a feedback through the price mechanism. And the real problem is that it's 25 years too late. So we've made all these promises in terms of healthcare, pension provision, et cetera, and looks likely we'll make more politically to the older generation in relation to long-term care and social care. And what's going to happen if we suddenly say, right, we're moving to a privately funded model? We can hardly say to those people who have participated in the state-funded model, they believe setting aside money, which was never set aside through the National Insurance Scheme, okay, we're abolishing old age pensions from tomorrow. We can say to people of working age, we're going to gradually replace your state pension accrual with a private pension model along Australian lines, using saving schemes instead. But it's very difficult to renege on those promises that we've already made to the older generation. Quite difficult morally, I should say, even more difficult politically, which is really what makes me rather pessimistic. The best news is that we muddle through, I think, making incremental adjustments. The worst news, I think, would be if there was a resurgence of worldwide economic growth, which I think is quite possible, led by Africa, Asia, South and Central America, if they reform their economies appropriately, a very large increase in world real interest rates from roughly zero back to normal levels of 3 or 4%. And we end up with sluggish growth at home, but we have to pay world real interest rates on our debt. That's a really pretty serious outturn.
Julian, let me finish up with you. If we are in a vicious circle, I mean, it, maybe not a death spiral. One doesn't want to be, hyperbolic about it. It might not be the apocalypse. But if all of these features are just sort of slowly ratcheting in the wrong direction and perhaps being self-reinforcing as well, what dials do we need to turn to start to make that a virtuous circle rather than a vicious one?
Well, I would like to see more discussion about the issues that we've touched on today. What seems to be happening is that people are thinking about ways of raising taxes in order to meet a certain path for public spending. We've seen that in the last few days, for example, about suggestions of a new wealth tax. And of course, the Treasury seems to be coming up with new wheezes for raising taxes of one type or another, left, right and centre. I think we need to go back a bit and actually think about how we are going to fund people in their old age. There have been a number of attempts and commissions and so on have looked at this, and it's always been decided that it's basically politically too difficult. But we can't continue to put this on off forever. Arguably, as Philip says, we've already left it too late anyway. But we need a proper grown-up discussion about how we are going to support people in their older age. We need to start from there rather than worrying about what the impact for taxes might be to meet a path when that path actually itself needs to change.
And let me just one final thought from you, Julian. And do you think that's likely? You know, does the IEA and people associated with the IEA and those who agree with our broad worldview can keep making these arguments? Is that the necessary thing? As you've said, let's change public discourse. Or does sort of mathematics kick in at some point that, you know, there is no alternative? We'll just have to do this. We can't, you know, we've now discovered in real time we can't squeeze more tax out of the working side of the economy. You know, where interest rates are going up, bond issues are hard or whatever. Does, you know, at what point is there just a reality that you have to go down mathematically the sort of path that you and Philip are advocating, even if you're not ideologically, intellectually persuaded?
Well, it's possible that, you know, realization that the public finances is not sustainable will change people's minds. But the problem is, by the time the maths really kicks in, it's probably going to be too late, because that's when, you know, the debt interest burden is taking off exponentially. I would be hopeful that we could tackle this, but there always seems to be something else that's more important, you know, whether that's the response to COVID or the amount of civil service bandwidth and political bandwidth devoted to Brexit. But I would very much hope this does at least feature in the, you know, in the next general election campaign, people start talking about these issues seriously. I'm not optimistic, though, as we've seen in particular around discussions about the NHS. It's very hard to say anything sensible about NHS or indeed things like reform of state pensions without getting an enormous amount of very uninformed stick coming back at you. So I'm not hopeful, but that's not a reason, of course, for giving up. And I think institutions like the IEA need to keep banging on about this, as indeed people like the OBR and the Institute of Fiscal Studies are as well.
Well, Philip and Julian, thank you for being insightful rather than hysterical. You've certainly made your contribution to public discourse here. Let's hope that others follow in your steps and we actually start to grapple with these problems in a meaningful and sensible and cool-headed sort of way. Real pleasure to have both of you joining us. Thanks to you both. Just to remind, we will link to Philip's article that I referenced earlier and to Julian's briefing paper in the show notes below. Thanks again, gentlemen, for joining us.